Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the days after 9/11, there was a huge outpouring of anger and, sadly, at times, violence towards Muslims. My guest today recounts the story of one of those episodes of violence to tell a much larger and thought-provoking story on what being American means. For Texas native Mark Stroman, a man by whose own admission went, quote, Arab hunting, unquote, in the days after 9/11, was in defending his people and his race from others. Others intent on harming America, who, incidentally, in his mind, were preventing him from achieving the American dream. For him, defending America meant going into Dallas area convenience stores and shooting dark-skinned immigrants. For Bangladeshi immigrant Race Buyan, it meant leaving home and family and a decent job to make an even better life in America, to become an engineer and provide for the family to come. Despite that shooting on one morning in Dallas, Race Buyan would achieve the American dream while Mark Stroman would go to death row. Yet Buyan would later remember, forgive, and actually eventually work to spare Stroman's life. Their stories, which intersect for a brief moment on September 21st, 2001, form the basis for the book The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. It's published by Norton. My guest today is author and New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas. He writes the Letter from America and Admit One columns for the New York Times and is the author of a previous book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. In The True American, he not only describes a moment of hate, but he also explores a bigger theme of the pursuit of the American dream, the loss of that dream for Americans left behind by a globalized economy, and our love-hate relationship with immigrants. Anand Giridharadas, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Give us a sense of how you first came across the story of Raisuddin Buyan and Mark Stroman, one of these incidents that occurred in the United States after 9/11, in which in the passions of 9/11, you had people acting out against basically dark-skinned people in this country. How did you first come across the story?
You know, I had been thinking for a long time, as is customary for many writers, about my next book after doing the first book. And I knew I wanted to do something on the American dream and this idea that it was not working anymore, at least as many people were describing. And I came to the idea that the real story to tell was that it was actually still working spectacularly for a lot of people and had completely stopped working for a lot of other people, and that those people lived side by side in the same country. And I spent a long time looking for stories that kind of were about those two different Americas mingling side by side. And one day saw a news article in the paper in 2011 that began with the notion that there was a man who was scheduled to be executed by the state of Texas for some of the crimes you mentioned, who was being forgiven and actually fought to be saved from death row by his victim, one of his victims, in his final days on earth. And I just thought to myself, you don't see that every day. And when I got into the story and started researching it, I realized that I had found my Two Americas story, because actually it was this Muslim immigrant from Bangladesh who was working in a gas station who, despite being shot in the face, managed to access an America that still works, even though he went through so much hardship to get there. And the man who shot him, a white supremacist in Dallas, who actually embodied an America that had stopped working, and that they came together brutally, collided brutally in this case. And it became kind of the subject of the next 3 years of my life.
And I love the title, The True American, because this is the phrase that Mark Stroman used to justify what he did. And in the days after 9/11, he basically went on a rampage going around to gasoline stations, and if you were dark-skinned, if you were Muslim, or he perceived you as Muslim, he came in and shot several people, as a matter of fact. He was only tried for one, but he shot several people, and in the case of Race Buyan, he was the only one who survived the shootings.
Race was very lucky, because in the other two shootings in these gas stations, Mark Stroman used a kind of traditional gun and traditional bullet. In the case of Race Buyan, for some reason, he used a bird hunting gun and sprayed 39 pellets into Race Buyan's head, two of which perforated his eye, went in through the front, out through the back. blinded him in that right eye, but spared his life. And it was because his life was spared that he began to ask, what can I do to repay God for saving me? And it took him many years to answer that question. But in the end, his answer was, I can forgive, and I can then fight to save this man from the death penalty. But more than that, I can use his story and my story to shine a light on the America that has stopped working and try, as a new immigrant in this country, a new American citizen, to make my new country better.
It was interesting. You really tell a lot of the story from Ray's viewpoints. Part of the, you know, when he came to America from Bangladesh, his images of America were from television. And, of course, that reality was totally obliterated once he got to the United States. And was he a graduate from the Air Force training program in Bangladesh, or was he almost
a graduate? He graduated from the Air Force Academy, and he'd actually been commissioned as an officer. He'd gone through military training, and he'd begun as an officer. And that takes an enormous amount of ambition and exam taking and passing through many layers of scrutiny. And yet, having achieved that, he was dissatisfied. And like so many of the people who have come to America over the decades and centuries, he had actually decent situation, but wanted something more, something intangibly more. And finally, he got the sense that that more was America.
And as many immigrants, very educated immigrants do, they start out at the bottom rungs. He was working for a family friend in Texas as working at a C store, basically saving his money to learn a trade, hoping to get work as an engineer at some point. And really that was his even after the incident, that was his arc and eventually came to pass.
You know, he, racer than like so many immigrants to America, understood that to rise here, sometimes you have to first fall. And he came from at the absolute top of his society. Being an Air Force officer in Bangladesh was the best of the best, the most respected. He would have been chauffeured around and sent on foreign educational courses and had country club memberships. But he was willing to come here and willing to work in a gas station and willing to sell people three tamales for a dollar, even though he had those skills and that background, because there was this kind of nebulous more that he wanted. And he felt that only America could give it to him. But he got here, and he was not in a great neighborhood in Dallas. He was kind of on the edges of eastern Dallas in a kind of forlorn area. And the thing that most struck him was that this America that he'd kind of read about and watched on TV and in the movies, in the neighborhood that he found himself in, was this profoundly lonely place. And there was poverty, and I'm sure as a smart man he understood that there was poverty everywhere. But in America, he observed that poverty was kind of compounded by isolation and loneliness. And he was shocked, coming from a poor country, one of the poorest countries in the world, that there was this third world America right next to the first world America that he had come to try to access.
He said, you know, in Bangladesh, we are poor together. Here, you're poor alone. Your family, there's no family support. There's no friend network. It's basically you're on your own when you're poor.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things, this has been an observation that has been made by sociologists and academics from, you know, Robert Putnam on the left to Charles Murray on the right for the last many years. We've been warned that this is happening to our society. But race observed it from the ground level. And one of the things that really distinguishes our poverty here in America from poverty in other countries is, in other countries, when you don't have resources, what you do have is people. In fact, people and resources are kind of substitutes. So if you live in India or Bangladesh or Nigeria, if you don't have access to resources, you make sure that you have community and family that can back you up and give you a place to live and feed you when you're hungry and give you health care access when you don't have it. In this country, part of what race observed and these sociologists have been showing us is the poorer you get, the less access to people you have. So you're much more likely to be divorced in America if you're poor. You're much more likely to have these kinds of problems of social isolation if you're poor. So in America, the people who least need community support have the most community support, and the people who most need community support least have community support. And it's actually one of the very strange features of American life today. And Race observed this and just could not understand how people functioned and got by without even the barest hint of that support. And a couple examples he observed, after several years after he was shot, he was kind of rebuilding his life. Before he forgave, but kind of a few years after the shooting, he was working at the Olive Garden. And one of the things he observed at the Olive Garden was his kind of native-born American colleagues, most of them, didn't have cars. Not because they couldn't afford the lease, but because they had no one in their lives, family, friends, no one, to co-sign on a lease for them. They had no one in their lives to pick them up and give them rides. So young women would be walking at night on the edge of the highway in 110-degree Dallas heat. And he just wondered, what is going on in this society that people could be so, people who've been here forever, could be so bereft of other people?
Now contrast those observations with the life of his attacker, Mark Stroman.
Mark Stroman very much grew out of the world that Race Bouillon was kind of there describing. He grew out of a kind of white working class family in a community in Dallas, which, you know, again, we keep hearing from these larger sociological observations, you know, is a community that has been kind of getting worse over the last generation. You know, hit by stagnating median wages and kind of the job situation, but also by fraying social fabric, weakening families, any number of other things, and hasn't really in this era of globalization been able to kind of maintain its grip on things. And Mark Stroman grows out of that world and has some of the problems of that world, but also has problems that are much more specific to him, you know, whether it's nightmares since boyhood, abusive parents, who kind of drank a lot and locked him in his room and even on Christmas dinner and, you know, made him pick the grass with his hands because he had a grass allergy, kicked him in the head, called him all kinds of names. Mother who told him that if she'd had $50 more, she would have aborted him.
And that's the other side of that equation is drugs and alcohol and the roots it's playing in that fraying family structure. I'm not sure if it's a symptom or a cause.
I think it's both. I mean, it's you have parents who are dependent on drugs and alcohol. They treat their kids terribly and neglect their kids. So a kid like Mark Stroman grows up. And then kind of sure as dawn, you know, as soon as he's kind of old enough to access these things, he is dabbling in the same chemicals and new chemicals. He started to do meth at one point, which was not uncommon in the part of the country that he was in. And you start to see this pattern. And then he had a kid when he was a teenager, and then that kid gets neglected, and a grandparent takes that kid to another town to keep it out of the way of these parents who can't handle it. And, you know, we still, in the part of the country that you're in now and that I spent in Dallas reporting on this book, there's a tendency to still think of oneself in these kind of American pastoral terms. And you listen to country music, and it's these solid old values. But the reality I found in a lot of the communities I reported on around Mark Stroman and his family was that you had people listening to country music but not really living country music realities or values anymore. The idea of a family, just the word family, is sort of a joke. I mean, people still use the word, but it doesn't refer to actually any kind of durable, committed structure around anybody. I mean, I met almost nobody in these worlds who had what anybody would have recognized as a family 30 years ago. You know, it's a series of kind of ephemeral transactions and arrangements and living arrangements and understandings that kind of moves kaleidoscopically and shifts every few weeks and months rather than, you know, a group of people committing to each other for the long haul. And it's very hard to understand how in an era that is ruthless on the economic side, very competitive globally on the economic side, how we as a country can withstand and compete in that world when so many of our people don't have the basic rudiments you get from a family and a community of being kind of made strong and whole in youth.
Yeah, no, I think these are some of the big questions this book brings up. In continuing with Mark Stroman, though, I was really struck by your conversations with his employer. Now, Mark had trouble with the law, and there was a gentleman who took him into his auto business. I think it was auto repair, body work, and his name was, I believe, Tom Boston. And he really gave Mark a chance, and Mark was on one of these, he was kind of one of these guys on the fence. He could have made a success of himself. He could have you know, there was a moment where he could have done the right thing. And I think Tom spoke about that in the book. He said, you know, we all have problems in our lives. We all have real tragedies in our life, and we can either overcome them or we can fall back. And Mark was one that fell back.
Absolutely. And that's a very apt point, because you see, Tom Boston actually said, you know, running a body shop in northern Dallas, when Mark Stroman came to work for him in his kind of early 20s, Tom Boston said he was one of the most ambitious individuals he'd ever met in his life, right? That he was keen to learn, that he was good with customers, that he was able to manage a bunch of rental accounts for this body shop. And then something would kind of call to him, and he'd lapse for a few weeks, and he'd start going to the strip club till 2 or 3 a.m., and he made the classic male error of trying to date the strippers instead of just watching them strip. And he lost himself in chemicals, and he would try to fight anybody who could possibly be interested in a fight with him. And he was surrounded by a bunch of other men like that. And one of the things I found in looking at the trial record in this case was any name I could find of anybody who he was kind of friends with and caught messing around with in boyhood, 10, 12, 13 years old, if I had their name and date of birth and I looked it up today, almost all of them were in jail for violent crimes. And so I think there's this larger question about actually a certain kind of manhood in American life today, in many of our communities. We have a lot of men like Mark Stroman, not at the extreme of what he did, but a lot of men in his social universe come of age with the kind of bodies of men, but in some ways the developmental level of boys, with this lashing out, this clear self-hatred that becomes a hatred of others, and this kind of hurt or be hurt attitude. And we see our community colleges, less and less people in community colleges are men. I think some community colleges, it's one-third of the students are men. We have a real problem in the kind of American underclass of men really not being whole and up to the demands of this century.
My guest today is Anand Giridharadas, author and New York Times columnist. His new book is titled The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Mark Stroman commits these series of hate crimes, really, and this book gets at so many elements of what's kind of, you know, weird and different and strange about our current society. In Texas, if they would have called these crimes a hate crime and convicted him of a hate crime, he would not have been on death row and eventually executed. He would have had life in prison, or life with a possibility of parole. That just sounds so perverse. They ended up trying him for the one crime in which he said, "Give me the money," which I found just so profoundly strange.
Yeah, a lot of our, you know, a lot of these laws are obviously old, and it may not be the same in every state, but in Texas at that particular moment in time, there was no life without parole. So if you got life, you could get out, and if you got the death, you know, obviously you would never get out. So if the prosecutors were determined to never have a chance that you would get out, they had to seek the death. There was no other option. And to seek the death, you can't just get someone on killing someone. You have to accuse them of committing capital murder, not just murder. And capital murder means murder committed during the commission of another crime. And one of those, you know, one of a handful, four, five, six crimes, arson, robbery, I think rape. And at that point in time, at least, hate crimes were not on that list of the other crimes. So if they had said his motive, his pursuit was to go Arab hunting, as Stroman himself had called it, he actually wouldn't have been able to get the death penalty and may have even gotten out someday. And the prosecutors were very determined not to let that happen, particularly because I think they had a lot of guilt about the state having blown a lot of previous opportunities to intervene in his life and maybe help him turn it around. So they were determined to pursue the death penalty, and the only way they could do that was by saying he'd committed robbery. And in none of the cases had he taken any money. In two of the cases, he hadn't even mentioned money or taken the money that was put out there. But in one case, he just said, "Give me the money," and fiddled with the register. Still didn't take anything. But the fact that he said that and did that fiddling doomed him and gave the prosecution as much of a pretext as they needed to be able to try him for the death penalty.
Well, the story continues as Reyes Buyon continues with his life. He's another factor of the poor. They save some sight in his eye. You mentioned the pellets that struck his eye, but he had horrible medical bills. And this is yet another story of the poor, you know, one catastrophe, not of his own making in any sense of the question. You know, somebody shoots you and your life is basically pulled out from under you because of medical bills. And yet he overcame that as well.
He did. But, you know, he, to go back to the beginning of it, he is admitted to the hospital, the ER, moments after he's shot. Ambulance picks him up, takes him to the hospital. The next day, with his mouth not moving, barely able to speak, his eye caked shut with the dark blood all over it, not able to see, obviously, not even able to open it, and his face, you know, swollen to kind of a watermelon, as he described it, he was discharged from the hospital. And he thought, well, that's a little bit strange, because I don't seem to be in very good shape right now. And I can't talk and I can't see, but this is a Christian hospital. They would never mean to do badly by me. These are good people, and this is the richest country in the world. If they're sending you out of the hospital, it's probably for the best. And it took him time to understand that in America, you know, they get you out of the hospital quickly if you don't have insurance, because you are their problem when you come in through the ER. But if you come back as an outpatient, you are your own problem. So they told him to come back as an outpatient, and he got $60,000 into medical debt, including a charge for his 911 call and his ambulance carriage. And, you know, it took years and years, 5-6 years, to deal with that debt and the anxiety it caused as a foreigner, wondering, are they gonna come after some Muslim guy who's fallen so far into debt in Texas, a debt to a Christian hospital? Am I going to get in trouble? And finally, his doctor's office, he had a doctor named Rand Spencer, who was a wonderful eye surgeon in Dallas, who kind of forgave him a lot of his bills, but there were still a bunch of other bills amounting to $50,000, $60,000. And this doctor applied on his behalf for a grant from the state of Texas for crime victims and was actually able to secure him money that paid all of those bills.
Yeah. Talk about the process he came towards forgiveness and his actual intervention in the capital murder sentence for Mark Stroman. I mean, he actually filed briefs that went to the Supreme Court trying to stop the execution.
He did. And so what happened is, you know, Race spent all these years rebuilding his own life and getting his life back in order and dealing with his debt, dealing with untreated depression, dealing with the health of his face and eye. And many years in, with his debt finally paid, with his health kind of finally whole, he was able to fulfill a lifelong promise to his mother to take her to Mecca in Saudi Arabia for the Hajj pilgrimage that is a sacred duty of Muslims. And when he was in Mecca, he had this very strong sense that God, having kind of given him space to worry about himself for these last many years, was now calling to him to refocus himself on others, on service. And he remembered that in that moment when he had been lying on the floor of the convenience store thinking he was dying, that he'd looked up at the sky, as many of us would, and said to God, if you save me now, I will dedicate the rest of my life to saving others. But then he hadn't done that because he had so much to save in himself. But now on that pilgrimage, he felt it was time. God was tapping him on the shoulder and telling him, I need you to do something for humanity. So he spent a long time thinking about, what can I do for humanity? I'm just one person. I'm an immigrant. I'm now a new citizen of the United States. What can I do? And finally came to the conclusion that the thing that most frustrated him in the world was the enmity between his adopted country, America, and his faith, Islam. And he said, I want to bring them together because they are both the best country and the best religion as far as he could figure it. And he didn't want them to fight. So he thought, how can I do that? I can forgive this man who shot me because of who I was. I can tell him that I love him. I can fight to save him from being killed in the name of mercy, in the name of my faith, in the name of the value of human life. And then I can use this story as a way to tell the world about the possibility of love, about there being a way to approach this other than revenge, there being this idea of mercy, which, as he noted, is central to Islam, but is actually central in every major world religion, although it gets less airtime than perhaps it could.
True, yeah. So he embarks on this. And Mark Stroman, on death row, you know, in the first years, he's writing manifestos talking about the demise of the white man. I mean, he's full-blown white supremacist. How is he affected? How is he affected by Race's overtures and efforts on his behalf?
You know, Race's overtures only began, you know, in 2011, 10 years into the commission of these crimes. And Mark had actually been on a journey of transformation over the course of those 10 years, long before Race re-entered his life. He, you know, all the bad influences in his life fell out of his life when he went to death row. And all of the new people who came into his life were really terrific people, by and large. Religious people, ministers, counselors, an Israeli documentary filmmaker who took an interest in him and became his friend, and others. And the remarkable thing is, although it's so easy to see Stroman as this kind of bone-rotten murderer, when you take a man in his 30s and you take away all the bad influences, even in his 30s, and you inject a bunch of new influences, lo and behold, the man changes, starts to change. He finds God. He starts to become a little more self-aware. He starts to understand how he was trapped in this cycle of hating and being hated and being hurt and hurting. And he starts to acknowledge that fundamentally he needs people. He depends on people. He starts to ask for what he needs in letters to his friends. He becomes a slightly more normal human being. And all of that laid the groundwork for when Race came back into his life in 2011, forgave him, and tried, by suing the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, tried to save Stroman from being executed. Stroman was flabbergasted, blown away. He said, "I have never known an act of kindness like this in my entire life."
Hmm. It is a very strong story, and it's a story for redemption, for forgiveness, and it's also a story of America, where we are economically, class-wise, and gets into all sorts of issues that we're still confronting and still trying to deal with and not doing a very good job of doing it.
I think, you know, we can do... I wrote it not to depress people, and it's actually in some ways not a depressing book, because I think there's still within us an America that works so well. And one of the things, you know, we're actually doing this week, and I'd love to invite your listeners to join, is to ask people, instead of just relying on any one definition of a true American, I'd love to invite your listeners to join a conversation online, on Twitter, Facebook, wherever they roam, about what they think a true American is. So we're asking people to kind of complete the sentence, hashtag true American is, and I'd love to hear from what so many of us think, because part of rebuilding the country is getting back in touch with all the range of values that make us who we are.
Well, this book does a wonderful job of touching on those themes. The name of the book is The True American. Anand Giridharadas, thanks very much for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be on your show.
New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas is the author of The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.